Thank you, Leanne. Thank you all for joining us this morning. On the day of the general strike, no less. That's kind of what we're thinking about back in Oakland, California, I'm sure. So as Leah mentioned, I do not work for Urban Sprouts, but I used to be a garden educator with them in 2007-2008, and I currently am an advisory board member. And so I'm really excited to be able to present some of the work that they've been doing as kind of a model and kind of food for thought for creating other projects that have an educational and youth development focus. So let me, I'm trying to juggle the slides and the mouse there. I have no relationships to disclose at this point. So I just wanted to give a brief outline of kind of our program model and who we are and the population that we serve. And then I hope to really get across the results of our program evaluation that we've been conducting over this last several years. And I wanted to finish with a little bit of how policies can support farm-to-school movements nationally. So our mission is really to serve the youth of San Francisco by forming relationships with schools and helping them become centers of community by creating these gardens that serve as not only a place to reinforce what they're learning in the classroom, but places where they can really come together and work towards a common goal and learn about health and eco-literacy. So we have kind of a unique history in that we were actually started as the result of a dissertation research project, which I think is a fact that will probably speak to a lot of the data geeks in the audience. So our founder, Michelle Ratcliffe, and is there a little bit of feedback? Are you hearing that? I'll try to not speak too close to this. Our founder, Michelle Ratcliffe, started Urban Sprouts in 2003-2004 with one school in San Francisco. And really, her goal was to figure out, okay, we know that urban gardening and school gardens and community gardens are great, and there's a lot of anecdotal evidence for why they, you know, can help build health and community. But she really wanted to see if we could quantify these results, because ultimately the data is what often speaks to, for example, policymakers and the larger community. So with that, she started a pilot project at one school, and then at the end of the 6 months there, the teachers and the students were so excited about this new garden that had been created and this garden curriculum that they asked Michelle and our other founder, Abby Jaramillo, to stay on. And with that, Urban Sprouts was born. So we've been expanding since then. At our height, we were reaching 800 students. In seven San Francisco middle and high schools, including one juvenile detention center. And as you can see, the population that we are serving really is diverse. Over 95% students of color, 60% of our students are eligible for federally reduced lunches, and unfortunately, you know, 90% of them had failed to reach their fitness standards in school. We have programs for them designed to kind of meet what they're doing in the science classroom and supplement it with garden-based education around nutrition and science. But we also have community programs, including programs that work with the families and the parents who are connected to our students, providing opportunities for them to learn about gardening and nutrition. And then we have peer nutrition programs in the local community. We also have a summer employment program, which hires high school students in order to teach middle school students in this more intensive sort of gardening summer camp, where they get more of an in-depth education than we can give them during the garden classes at school. So I titled the presentation "A Recipe for Success." And that is kind of tongue-in-cheek. Of course, there is no one-size-fits-all approach, and there is no one best way of doing things. But I just wanted to talk a little bit about our program model and the theory behind it, and then kind of what it looks like on the ground. So there are actually more of you than I thought would show up at 8:30 in the morning, so I only brought 20 copies of our model. But if you want a copy of this after the presentation, please come up to me, and I can refer you to our website and so on. So as I mentioned, our organization was started as a part of a research project, which is really convenient because the idea of evaluation and the idea of figuring out and analyzing the best sort of themes and ways of practice have been embedded in our history from the beginning. So when Dr. Ratcliffe started Urban Sprouts, she was really interested in looking not only at sort of the outcomes, and she was coming to this from more of an environmental perspective that, rather than a health perspective, so thinking about how kids could impact the environment, for example. But very quickly she saw that one of the sort of biggest outcomes that could happen out of gardening is really kids learning how to have healthier behaviors and healthier lifestyles. So she did a lit review, and this model will probably be familiar to most of you or all of you from the public health field. And she saw that as a part of Bandura's social cognitive theory, there was a really great base for the type of interactions that she was trying to quantify in terms of the youth and gardens and the environment. So, of course, the social cognitive theory, it theorizes that, you know, our behaviors are not just a result of our environment, right? If you put us in a certain environment, you can't just expect us to adopt a new behavior right out. So this is really important for people who are working in, for example, community gardens or school gardens, because there's a lot more that goes into it than just making sure the environmental cues are there. Personal factors such as resiliency, the development of new skills, teamwork, and so on also play a major role. And so the model that she created really takes cues from Bandura, and then it's really adapted to the environment of the school garden. As you see, there are actually some boxes that are added at the bottom because she was also interested in thinking about, okay, now that we have kind of a framework for thinking about individual level outcomes, how do we now think about what these aggregated impacts on students might have on the community? So I'm going to step through just a few parts of the model. I can't get into full detail about this, but again, please come talk to me if you have any more questions about how she got to this point. And then I should also note that, so this is part of her dissertation, but there was actually, earlier this year, there was an article that was published in connection with this, and I'm going to show some data from it. It's in the Health Promotion Practice Journal. So taking a look at one part of the model, the environment piece. What does this look like in the context of farm-to-schools and school garden programs? So here's kind of a checklist, and just to give you an idea of how we use the model, not only do we use it for evaluation purposes, but we also use it as kind of a planning tool to make sure that when we're designing our programs and designing our curriculums, we're thinking about all of these different factors. So the school learning environment encompasses curricular, physical, and social learning. In terms of what that looks like on the ground, for a curricular environment, we gear our curriculum towards what they're learning in the classroom by connecting with teachers and referring to the state standards for science. But we also, of course, add in the very important health and nutrition pieces of the curriculum. Here is an example of students comparing food labels from processed foods to nutrition cards that show the nutritional content of uncut produce. We also do things like taste tests. We have students create skits and have games. And we really try to make it as interactive as possible. The physical learning environment is, of course, what people, I think, really think about when we talk about school gardens, and these are the sorts of images that really are kind of lure people in, because if we could take a step back from this photo, if you were to just pan away, you would see that this is a really urban area. It's surrounded by concrete. There are not very many places for these students to play in a safe environment. So the idea here is that we're creating a place where kids can interact with nature, where they can see a diversity of plants grow over the season and see everything change, and where they have a place in sort of cultivating and growing food over a season. And, of course, the social learning environment is critical, especially at this age. We work only with middle and high school students, and the role of peer networks and of peer pressure, of, as I'm sure all of you can relate to, is especially critical during this period. So here we're really concerned with making sure that our programs incorporate opportunities for people to work in teams, for them to work across generations with teachers and other volunteers who come to our programs, and for them to model good behaviors. So we start every year by doing group agreements with our classes where we talk about our goals for the year. We talk about what behavior we expect of students and then what sort of disciplinary measures we would see if somebody is not participating, for example. So moving to another part of the model, the personal factors, of course, can also help drive our final goal, which is, you know, from the health perspective, the behaviors that come as a result of our program. So by personal factors, we're really looking at the development of the whole person. And here are just some examples of the types of skills that we hope to cultivate as a result of our programs. So there's not only the academic knowledge, and I mentioned that we work with our teachers in order to gear our food and nutrition education to the science curriculum, but also we want to make sure that our programs are cultivating social and moral and emotional development. So things like responsibility, patience, problem solving, and really a sense of efficacy, the fact that they are creating a change, a positive change that they can actually see in their school community. And then, of course, the goal is that with these changes in the environment, with these changes in sort of the personal efficacy, that we do start to see changes in behaviors. So this includes not only health and wellness, but also other sorts of eco-literacy behaviors. And so in terms of outcomes, things that we could measure for this include fruit and vegetable consumption, fruit and vegetable preferences, physical activity, teamwork, and then eco-literacy, so actions to take care of the environment. So that is kind of a, you know, two-minute overview of the model that I'm sure Michelle spent many, many hours wrapping her brain around it. So if you have more questions about it, please. I did not get into full detail about how it was developed, and there are some other theoretical frameworks behind it. But I really wanted to, get into what some of our results have shown from the past several years. So we were fortunate, as a result of our main funder, the California Nutrition Network, to have resources since 2003 to evaluate the results of our program. So what this has taken shape as is we do pre and post surveys. So at the beginning of the year and end of the year, we do fruit and vegetable preference surveys. And then at the end of the year, we do more in-depth interviews with staff and focus groups with students. And then the Urban Sprout staff, we also do in sort of our internal reflections. And here is just one example of what the survey looks like. We do it through SurveyMonkey, so the kids get to go to the computer lab and so on. It's a little bit more interactive. We do it on paper. And we're asking kids about, did you eat this? Do you recognize this food? Did you eat it recently? And then whether or not they like it. And here is from the published study that I mentioned that came out earlier this year. And this is kind of the most airtight of our studies, or of our data, and it was only from the 2003-2004 year, so it was really when we just got started. We have a lot more data since then that is, you know, has not gone through the same level of analysis, and I'm going to present a little bit of that later, but I wanted to give you kind of the gold standard first. So we have seen that as a result of just the pilot program, so in the very first year, you know, even before we had really built the full program, that we did see a change in students' preferences and their willingness to eat fruits and vegetables. So as you can see, there is a statistically significant difference between the garden group, so those who had been through this pilot project, and then the control group, which was another school, on a number of these outcomes. For some reason, and this may be as a result of the fact that this was an early pilot, when we did the same sorts of test, but really using actually a taste test method, so asking students to taste 5 different vegetables and then asking them to classify whether or not they like them and whether or not they eat them at home in school. The results between the control and garden group were much, they were not statistically significant. But like I said, that was sort of the gold standard for our research, but we've conducted evaluations since then, and I want to share a little bit more of the anecdotal evidence. So this is from our summer and school programs, where we have 20 to 25 kids every summer who go through this intensive education on school gardening. And we see that students in the program really report that they are changing their preferences. And they are changing their behaviors, in fact. I love this quote about this student who is actually not only starting to eat more fruits and vegetables, but is telling her family and friends about it. And then, of course, as with many community-based programs, often the richest data is the least quantifiable. I wanted to share some of the things that our kids have said. I'll just read a couple. My favorite part of the garden program was cooking because we got to try healthy foods. I learned to work with other people instead of being all selfish. And I do better in school now because my body is not being energized with Cheetos, it's being energized with lettuce. And here are, of course, some points that our teachers brought up about how the gardens really support the curriculum that they're teaching in the classroom. And I'll let you read those. And I'm running out of timer, so I'm going to run through this part pretty quickly. But I just wanted to give a little bit of I wanted to share a few resources for you in terms of ways to take this example and implement it in your own community or to research the impacts in your own community. So our founder, Michelle Ratcliffe, she's one of the conveners of the Farm to School and School Garden Research Consortium. It's at datadorksunite.ning.com. And then, of course, at a federal level, I mean, Farm to School has definitely come ahead of the policy here, but we're trying to keep up in the policy world. So at the federal level, we've had a few very high-profile policies supporting Farm to School, but we also really recommend that you look to your state and local level for other potential policies. Some states, for example, have created their own Farm to School programs that have staff that are really promoting Farm to School programs. And some resources that you can look to for more information on state and local policy, but also implementation, are listed here. I highly recommend the Farm to School Network and the USDA Farm to School team. They've got a wealth of information. Here's a few more resources about kind of the evaluation piece, if that is something that really interests you. And I'm happy to share the link to this presentation. So please come talk to me if this is an area of interest for you. And finally, I just wanted to thank all of you again for your participation. And here's my contact information.